Imagine this. You're walking down the street. Maybe you're grabbing a coffee on your lunch break.
Right, just a normal day.
Exactly. The sidewalk is crowded, traffic is humming along, and suddenly you hear a police officer shout, "Stop resisting."
Yeah, that phrase just it cuts through everything, doesn't it?
It really does. And what is your immediate, like, gut level thought if you are like most of us, or the bystanders pulling out their phones, or even the jury sitting in a courtroom later on?
You assume the person on the ground is the problem.
Right. You hear those two words, and your brain automatically concludes that the civilian is the author of the violence.
Yeah, we are we're completely culturally conditioned to do exactly that. Those two words, they basically act like a moral switch for the public. It's totally binary.
Like flipping a light switch.
Literally, we hear stop resisting and we instantly read the scene from the officer outward. We assume the person struggling is the cause of the police action, right? Rather than the subject of it. We take the phrase as this objective, factual description of legal defiance.
But what if that phrase is actually a legal illusion? Like, what is in a lot of these street encounters, those words are just being used to mask incredibly weak police work?
And that is the perfect question to ask.
Well, that's our mission for this deep dive today. We're unpacking this really fascinating April 2026 thought piece by Eric Sanders. It's titled The Lie of Resisting Arrest.
That's such a good
It
piece.
really is. And we're going to look at the actual mechanics of New York law and federal case law to understand how this phrase is used in the real world.
Yeah, and how it's frequently abused, quite frankly.
Exactly.
So we really need to break down how resisting arrest is, legally speaking, what we call a derivative offense.
Right.
Like it doesn't just exist in a vacuum. We're going to look at how officers sometimes use narrative shortcuts and outright sequencing errors to basically manufacture legal authority out of thin air.
Out of nowhere. And by the end of this conversation, we want to give you, the listener, the specific mental checklist you need to spot when an arrest is actually just a case of, well, chronology fraud.
I love that term, chronology fraud.
Isn't it great? It really gets to the heart of the manipulation here. So let's unpack the core misconception first. Because reading through the Sanders piece, the biggest hurdle seems to be that everyday citizens mistakenly believe resisting arrest is this, self-justifying independent charge.
Yes.
Like you can just be arrested solely for resisting.
And that is the fundamental myth right there. Sanders points out that the phrase operates as this cultural solvent.
A cultural
Right.
solvent.
Think about what a solvent does, you know? It dissolves things. The moment an officer shouts, "Stop resisting," it dissolves public scrutiny. It just washes away our critical thinking.
Oh, absolutely.
Civilians naturally confuse an arrestee's biological physical reaction, like fear, pulling away, tensing up with actual legal
It
defiance.
looks bad.
It looks terrible. But under New York law, specifically Penal Law 205.30, resisting arrest is not an independent source of police authority. It is strictly a derivative offense.
Meaning it derives from something else.
Yeah.
Like it has to have a foundation. The police can't just walk up, grab you, and when you pull away, say, aha, you're resisting.
Exactly. Which is the exact opposite of how it often plays out on the street. The law explicitly requires an authorized arrest.
Okay, what does that mean exactly?
It means the police must already have lawful authority, so like a warrant or probable cause, that you committed a specific underlying crime before the physical struggle ever begins.
Before hands are even laid on.
Right. If that underlying legality isn't established first, the charge of resisting arrest legally cannot exist. The courts have been very clear on this.
Sanders mentions a few cases, right?
Yeah, cases like Curry v. City of Syracuse and People v. Stevenson, they essentially say, if a cop doesn't have probable cause before they put their hands on you, any subsequent resisting charge is void. It's just gone.
But wait, I can hear people right now screaming at their speakers, like, isn't it illegal to fight the police even if the arrest is bad?
Right, the old don't fight it in the street, fight it in court argument.
Exactly.
And
Because we've all been taught that.
it is illegal to fight the police.
Yeah.
That is a massive point of public confusion that we really need to clear up here.
Let's do it.
So New York does have a law, Article 35, that says citizens cannot use physical force to resist an arrest, even an unauthorized one.
Right.
But here is the critical distinction that gets lost in all of this. That law simply limits civilian self-help.
Meaning what?
It just means you aren't allowed to start a brawl in the street to get away. However, it does not retroactively transform an illegal arrest into a lawful one.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, it doesn't magically grant the officer legal authority they didn't have 5 minutes ago.
Okay, let's make this tangible for a second. It's kind of like getting a building permit.
Okay, I like where this is going.
Say I decide I want a new garage, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I don't go to the city. I just start illegally pouring concrete in my backyard.
Sounds messy.
Very. And then the building inspector catches me, shows up, and starts yelling at me.
Yeah.
I can't then go to a judge and say, well, the building inspector showed up and got mad, so that interaction retroactively serves as my permit.
No, you definitely cannot do that.
Right. The lawful authorization has to come first, before the digging starts.
That is a brilliant way to frame it. The state must justify its authority at each step before it imposes the next step of force. The permit absolutely has to exist before the concrete is poured.
Okay, so if the law is so strict about requiring authorization before an arrest, how do everyday street encounters go wrong so quickly?
Right.
Like, how do we get these massive chaotic struggles on the sidewalk over minor things?
Well, it really comes down to how police artificially manufacture a resistance narrative. And to understand how they do this, we have to look at the rules of engagement for street stops.
Okay.
In New York, there is this legal framework called the DeBoer framework. And it establishes four strict levels of police escalation.
Four levels. Got it.
Yeah. Level one is just a simple request for information. An officer walks up and says, hey, did you see anything weird happen here?
Super casual.
Right. Level two is a common law inquiry based on a founded suspicion. Level three is a forcible stop, what we generally know as a Terry stop, based on reasonable suspicion.
Okay. And the last one.
Only at level four do you have actual probable cause to make an arrest.
So an officer can't just jump from level one, asking a basic question straight to level four and, like, throw someone against a brick wall.
They absolutely cannot skip steps without justification. But in reality, on the street, this is exactly where the distortion happens.
So how does that play out?
Let's walk through a pretty common scenario. An officer might approach someone with incredibly weak predication, maybe just a hunch, or maybe the person, you know, looks suspicious.
Which is very subjective.
Highly subjective. By law, they are at level one. They can only ask questions. But instead of staying at level one, the officer decides to immediately crowd the person's space. They block their path, or maybe even grab them by the jacket.
And when a stranger suddenly grabs your jacket, you react. I mean, that's not a legal calculation. That's just biology.
Exactly. The central nervous system just takes over. The civilian has a completely normal human reaction. They flinch. They step back. Maybe they raise their hands to shield themselves or instinctively pull their arm away.
Which anyone would do.
Right. But here's the trick. Instead of recognizing that as a natural pain or fear response, the police rewrite that biological reaction into official defiance.
Wow.
Yeah. They introduce the physical force first. The civilian naturally reacts to that force. And then the police use that reaction as proof that they were entitled to arrest the person all along.
That's wild. And reading the sources, it seems like they often use disorderly conduct as the trap to make this stick, right?
Oh, disorderly conduct is the classic catch-all. Under Penal Law 240.22, on paper, it's an incredibly narrow law. It's designed to prevent actual public riots or major disruptions.
Like a massive brawl in a bar or something.
Exactly. But in bad street work, it becomes this incredibly malleable holding tank for, essentially, contempt of cop.
Contempt of cop. I like that.
If an officer is just dissatisfied with a citizen's demeanor, maybe the person argued back or asked too many questions or just didn't walk away fast enough, the officer writes it up as disorderly conduct.
Just to have something on paper.
Right. It creates this weak, artificial predicate. Then, when the officer grabs them and the physical struggle happens, the resisting arrest charge acts as the stabilizer. It justifies the whole messy sequence.
Okay, but let me play devil's advocate here for a second.
Sure.
Street encounters are chaotic. Blood is pumping. Adrenaline is through the roof. How is an officer supposed to know exactly what level of the framework they're at while someone is, like, screaming at them on a busy sidewalk?
Mm.
It feels like we're asking for academic precision in a back alley brawl.
And that is the reality of policing, right? It is difficult. But that adrenaline and chaos is exactly why the law demands strict discipline.
Because the stakes are so high.
Exactly. The legality must precede the force. It cannot result from the arrestee's reaction. You just cannot use your own physical force to create the very resistance you later cite as your legal justification.
The concrete before the permit.
Exactly. The burden is completely on the state to justify the escalation before they take it. If an officer lacks the discipline to do that in a chaotic moment, they don't get to use resisting arrest as a doctrinal escape hatch to fix their mistake.
Okay, which brings us to the courtroom, right?
Yes, the legal arena.
If these street-level escalations are legally flawed from the start, if the permit wasn't pulled, how do these police narratives actually survive in front of a judge? Like, how do they get away with it on paper?
Well, they survive because of a very specific trick of timing. Police departments often use the phrase resisting arrest as an institutional cover story to launder the force they use.
Launder the force?
Yeah. For years, the traditional police tactic in court was what defense attorneys call the freeze frame defense.
Okay, you've got to break down the freeze frame defense. How does that actually work in a police report?
So it's essentially amputating the inconvenient beginning of the encounter.
Cutting out the bad parts.
Right. When the officer sits down to write the official report, they don't include the part where they walked up with no probable cause. They start the narrative at the exact second the civilian flailed or tensed up.
Oh, wow.
They compress the chronology. They omit the improper approach, the weak predicate, the premature grabbing.
They just skip right to the reaction.
Exactly. They just freeze frame on the civilian's physical reaction and say to the judge, "Look at this violent movement. I had no choice but to use force."
But the landscape on this just shifted dramatically, didn't it? I mean, the Supreme Court recently weighed in on this.
They did, yeah, in a massive 2025 Supreme Court case called Barnes v. Felix. And this ruling completely destroyed that police-edited chronology.
That's huge.
It's massive. The court recognized what was happening and ruled that judges evaluating use of force can no longer put on chronological blinders.
Chronological blinders.
Right. They cannot just look at the final freeze-framed moment of the physical struggle anymore. Judges are now legally required to look at the full continuous sequence of events leading up to the force.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting to me. This is like, it's like walking into a movie theater halfway through the climax.
Oh, that's a great comparison.
Right. You walk in,
yeah.
Look at the screen, and see the hero throwing this brutal punch. If you only see that 5-second clip, you have absolutely no idea if they are defending themselves against a villain or if they just walked up and randomly attacked an innocent person.
You're completely lacking context.
You lack all the context. So what the Barnes ruling does is it forces the court to sit down, rewind the tape, and watch the whole movie from the opening credits.
That is precisely the effect. And because of this ruling, defense attorneys now have an incredibly powerful strategy.
How so?
Well, they can heavily leverage this Barnes totality requirement in court to expose how officers created the danger themselves or how they escalated prematurely.
So they can cross-examine differently.
Exactly. When an officer testifies that a suspect pulled away, the defense lawyer can now aggressively ask, "After what? After what kind of stop did this person pull away? After what physical escalation by the state?"
Because the preceding events matter now.
Right. It legally prevents the state from hiding its own constitutional failures behind the final seconds of a struggle.
Okay, so Barnes forces courts to look at what happened before the force. Mm. But let's flip the scenario for a second.
Sure.
What happens when the police actually do have a completely lawful arrest? Let's say they have a rock-solid warrant for someone's arrest. They approach perfectly, and the person genuinely resists.
Okay, a fully authorized arrest.
Yeah. Does a lawful arrest give the police a blank check to use whatever force they want to get the person in cuffs?
Not at all. That's another big misconception. Even a completely lawful arrest and even a valid resisting arrest charge do not authorize unlimited force. No. Under New York Penal Law 35.30, force is tied strictly to necessity. The statute says physical force can only be used when and to the extent it is reasonably believed necessary to effect the arrest.
When and to the extent.
Exactly. That means the justification for force has to be reassessed continuously, second by second, in motion. Once a suspect is controlled, the legal justification for force immediately evaporates.
And Sanders brings up a couple of very heavy federal cases to illustrate this, doesn't he?
He does, yeah. Cases like Tracy v. Freshwater and Jackson v. Tolado out of the Second Circuit.
What happened in those?
Well, let's look at the scenarios. The courts ruled that using pepper spray or chemical spray on a suspect who was already handcuffed and restrained is a constitutional violation.
Wow, even if they were fighting before.
It simply does not matter if the person was violently fighting the police 2 minutes earlier. Past resistance does not automatically validate future violence.
That makes sense.
Yeah, once the person is pinned or grounded or cuffed, the necessity for significant force ends, period.
Which makes total logical sense. And yet, I mean, we've all seen the viral videos.
Too many of them.
Right. A suspect is clearly restrained, completely immobilized by three or four officers on the pavement. And you still hear an officer screaming at the top of their lungs, "Stop resisting, stop resisting."
Right.
If an officer is shouting that at someone who is already pinned to the ground and handcuffed, who's that performance really for? Are they actually talking to the suspect, or are they talking to the bystanders recording them on their phones?
And that is the most crucial question we can ask. It speaks to what Sanders calls the group production of resistance.
The group production.
Yeah. We have to realize that resisting arrest is rarely just a solo accusation by one rogue officer. It is an organizational narrative.
How so?
When an officer shouts that phrase over a completely restrained person, it acts as a cultural weapon. Yes, it redirects sympathy from the bystanders and it lowers public scrutiny. But more insidiously, it anesthetizes the other officers on the scene.
Wait, how does it anesthetize the other officers? What do you mean by that?
Well, excessive force in group encounters is rarely sustained by one actor alone. It survives because surrounding officers stand by and do nothing.
Oh, I see.
The primary officer shouts, "Stop resisting," while striking or pepper spraying a restrained person, and the surrounding officers subconsciously use that shout to justify their own failure to intervene.
They just accept the narrative in the moment.
Right. They treat their passivity as professional restraint. They tell themselves, well, he's telling him to stop resisting, so he must still be resisting. It masks what is actually happening, a collective constitutional failure.
Wow. Okay, so now that we fully understand the mechanics of this legal illusion, from the initial street contact to the freeze frame paperwork defense to this group performance of shouting for the cameras, how do we actually hold the system accountable?
Right. Where does the buck stop?
Exactly. Where does it stop?
Accountability really has to start with police supervisors. Okay. Supervisors must rigorously audit incident reports to prevent the misuse of these resisting charges.
So it's on the sergeants and lieutenants.
Absolutely. A patrol supervisor who signs off on a report isn't just, you know, an administrative observer pushing paper. They are part of the constitutional sequence.
They're active participants.
Yes. If a supervisor simply signs off on a report that flattens the sequence of events or omits the weak predicate offense, they are directly engaging in chronology fraud.
And that's not just bad management, right? I mean, that's a serious legal problem.
It is a massive legal liability. Under federal case law in the Second Circuit, fabricating this timeline can elevate from a simple administrative paperwork error to a criminal fabrication of evidence.
A civil rights violation.
Exactly. A due process violation. Supervisors need to implement a strict checklist.
What kind of checklist?
When reviewing an arrest, they must ask a few key things. What was the underlying offense before hands were laid on?
Right. The permit before the concrete.
Exactly. Did the officers escalate first? Did the strikes or force continue after control was achieved? If the supervisor doesn't force the officer to articulate the original predicate offense, they become complicit in narrative laundering.
But accountability isn't just on the supervisors in the precinct. Sanders translates these complex legal requirements into some really practical takeaways for everyday citizens, too.
Which is so important.
It is. Because we are out there. We are the ones observing. We are the ones recording these police encounters on our phones when things go sideways on the street.
Exactly. Observers need practical guideposts to evaluate if police conduct is actually remaining within legal boundaries, rather than just getting swept up in the adrenaline of the moment.
So what does this all mean for you, the listener? If you are an observer on the street, Sanders gives you a very simple checklist.
Let's hear it.
First, look beyond the struggle. Don't just get mesmerized by the physical wrestling on the ground. Look for the catalyst.
The starting point.
Right. Ask yourself, what was the lawful reason for the stop before the officer's hands ever went on the person? And then look for the end. Watch the timeline of the force. Did the strikes or the knees or the pepper spray continue after the handcuffs clicked?
Did the violence continue after control was physically achieved?
Exactly. That is the exact discipline Sanders is calling for from all of us. We have to stop starting the story in the middle, which is where the optics are generally worst for the citizen and best for the police.
Right.
We have to insist on looking at the actual unedited sequence.
That is so well said. It's about seeing the whole picture.
This has been a heavy but incredibly necessary deep dive. To synthesize everything we've talked about today, the core takeaway from Eric Sanders' piece is that resisting arrest cannot be used as a band-aid to justify initial police mistakes.
It just can't.
It is a derivative charge. It demands a lawful foundation. It is not a magic word that excuses unconstitutional behavior.
It's not a legal talisman. It cannot repair a bad street stop. It cannot validate gratuitous force on a restrained person. And it absolutely cannot survive if we as a society insist on examining the true, unedited chronology of the encounter.
And that leaves us with a final thought for you to mull over. If the phrase resisting arrest has been so successfully weaponized as a cultural solvent to launder unconstitutional force, what other official-sounding procedural phrases in our justice system have we been culturally conditioned to accept as absolute truth without ever questioning the legal reality underneath them?
Oh, that's a great question.
Right. Think about that next time you hear a legal buzzword on the evening news. Until next time.